Welcome to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show about clever, quirky, and passionate people that make our state great. Today, our first Fascinating Ohioan comes from right here at our station, WOSU. She's one of the creators of Immerse, a sensory-friendly concert for children who are autistic. These one-hour events include music, movement, activities, and a quiet area for those who may feel overwhelmed. The creator, or the co-creator, rather, is Classical 101 Program Director Cheryl Dring. Welcome to All Sides, Cheryl.
Thank you.
You know, I've been here for a year, and this is the first time we've been on air together, ever.
I know. It seems unlikely.
And yet, here we are. And I do want to let our listeners know that we are waiting for President Joe Biden to address the nation. When he does, we will go to live coverage of his speech. But for now, Cheryl, tell me about Immerse. Where did the idea for this concert come from?
You know, actually, the idea really sort of started with one of our other hosts, our morning host, Christopher Purdy, who your listeners also know.
From the arts and culture shows.
Exactly. As a staff on the classical team, we had been talking about ways we know music could be impactful outside of just playing it on the air. And so as we looked to reach out into the community, we were having conversations about those things. And Christopher has an adult daughter who is autistic. And it was very striking to me that he said one day, you know, I've never taken her to a concert in her life. And as someone whose life is so wrapped up in music, I just found that really stunning. And so he said, yeah, it's not something that we could really negotiate with her sensory needs. And so we started talking about sensory-friendly concerts and the fact that some orchestras and things do them, but they're really their concession to autistic children is just to have a room where they can go to kind of get away from the overwhelm. And so we thought, well, what if we did something that was a little more tailored? And so we started talking about what that would look like. And we'd kind of had it just on the back burner until one of my colleagues over in the School of Music had said, you know, my mom is thinking about supporting some sort of program. Should we talk together about that? And I said, absolutely. And so we figured that it would be a really powerful partnership to take the School of Music with their young music students and the Neisonger Center with their long history of research and work in the field, of autism and special needs, because we knew that as much as we were enthusiastic about it, that we could take a wrong step and not know. So when we got the donor in to walk through the space, she mentioned that she was a retired special ed teacher. And I thought, oh, we've really got to work together, because we've got a lot of projects kind of always bubbling in our back mind. But yeah. In a nonprofit, you never imagine that you might be able to fund those things. And so I thought, maybe we've
perfect
got something.
Perfect time, perfect donor.
Exactly. And so, the enthusiasm was great. And we started talking about, well, what does this look like? You know, what do we think is missing? And a lot of it was just crafting the program for young people who are autistic and not just trying to fit them into a space that was intended for neurotypical folks.
Yeah, a lot of times sensory friendly gets interpreted to mean quieter.
Right.
Less lights, less noise. Mm-hmm. But the Immerse concerts have a variety of seating. They have like scarves and things. You're allowed to get up, move about the space. You're encouraged to.
Right. And, you know, we kind of made that quiet mistake the first time. And so all the music was very sort of sedate. And it worked fine. But we thought, we can push these kids a little further. Because one of the pieces that really seemed to resonate with them was one that was very rhythmic. And so I thought, okay, So we talked again, and we, you know, the second time we did the program, we tweaked it a little bit. But knowing attention spans, we thought, okay, about 20 minutes of music. And again, as you mentioned, there were variations in seating. So there was a big rug at the front with pillows and stuffed animals. So if they wanted to crash out in front of the stage, they could. But then we had seating of lines of chairs like you would get in a concert hall. And then we had a place in the back. If they wanted to sit at a table with their parents, they could. So so that seemed to work well. And Christopher, as our MC, was very clear about saying, mostly to the parents, don't worry about your kids. This space is for them. They're not going to bother anyone if they move around. If they're noisy, let them do what they need to do. And so it was really interesting to watch the parents kind of wrestle with that, because their first impulse was to say, no, sit down, be quiet. And it didn't work that way. So it was really pretty moving to see how it worked out with the parents particularly.
What has been the community reaction to these kind of events? Because I have to imagine once the dam breaks, once you're no longer worried about upsetting other people at the concert and your kids just go, I can't imagine what that must feel like.
You know, the parents have been really lovely, and in sharing it, particularly within parents' groups, because, you know, so many of these parents are involved in parent groups of children with autism. And so it's been interesting to see how enthusiastic they are. And we've gotten some great feedback. We've had some kids who returned. And it's been really lovely. We were very careful that first time, because it was a pilot program for us, and we didn't want to broadcast it too widely, because we thought, let's work the bugs out first. And well, we feel like we've got the bugs worked out.
Which is why you're here.
Which is why I'm here, getting it out more broadly. And something that, you know, is probably worth mentioning is these are very small groups. So maybe 15 kids per session. And so, you know, we've held the registration pretty tightly. But we still, as of today, I think we have about 12 spaces left. So we're doing two sessions on November 16th, one at 1 p.m. and one at 3 p.m. So I know we have some openings in that 3 p.m. session. But if you're interested and want to read more, you can go to our website, which is wosu.org/immerse, and it will take you directly to that event on the event page, and you can register there. You can learn more. There's even a social narrative that you can go through with your kid that walks them through what their day would be like.
Is there any cost for people to attend?
No, none at all. We're trying to remove as many barriers from this sort of thing. So we have support from a donor, Norma Hedgecoth, and also a local law firm that has signed on, Carlisle Patchen and Murphy. And so, you know, they're helping us defray the costs there. And the School of Music is also helping us defray the costs of parking. So in the parking garage here right across the street from us, they're making parking validation available. So, yep, if you can get here with your kid and register in advance, then there's no cost at all.
That's really great. So what kind of music will be played at the concerts on November 16th?
So this year, we're doing a musical zoo.
Oh.
So we'll have instruments like, you know, violins, and I think even a trombone maybe, that are going to be portraying animals. And then I think at the end, the instruments are going to get together and do Hakuna Matata from Lion King or something like that. But we have the concert at the beginning, and the students are encouraged to talk about the piece and the instrument, and so that the kids are kind of getting some interaction there. And then at the end of that 20 minutes, we break out into activities. And so we have one that's, you mentioned scarves earlier, we have one that's movement. And so they can get scarves and swirl them around. We even had one kid one year who was setting up almost a movie. He was like, now the blue scarf is the sky, and then the green scarf is the...
Oh, I love that.
It was wonderful. And he had balled up the yellow scarf to be the sun. And so it's so interesting to see them, you know, sort of take it and run with it. We had two little girls last session who came in their little sparkly dresses. And so they were having so much fun moving around and making their dresses sparkle. But we also have an art station, so they can make things or color or draw. And then we also have a little bit further out in the building, a music session. And this is one that I think has really been popular with the kids because we have all of these little noisemaker instruments, you know, the little blocks with sandpaper and the little sticks you can clank together. And so we've got some students and some trainers from Nysonger who are down on the floor with them and, you know, teaching them little rhythmic patterns. And so they're getting to play a little bit. And one of the first sessions we did, we had a young man who came in who was totally nonverbal. And you could tell he was very, very sort of stressed about being here, just kind of making noises. And then by the time we got in and the music started, he began to relax. By the time we got to the music making portion, he was grinning from ear to ear and, you know, playing these little rhythmic patterns back to the trainers. And, you know, they were praising him for what a good job he was doing. And it was such, it was very moving, I think, for a lot of us to see that impact that music could have.
Yeah, especially for kids who typically can't go to concerts, can't go, maybe struggle to participate in music class at school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if they needed to run around, we always had somebody posted on the door, and we found out we also had somebody posted on the back of the stage because we had a couple of runners, but that was fun. Everybody just sort of rolled with it, and there was a lot of love in that room.
Again, we are waiting still for President Joe Biden to address the nation. When that happens, we will be transitioning to national coverage here at WOSU. Right now, we're talking about the Immerse program at WOSU and its co-creator, Cheryl Dring, and how it came to be. I think this is such... What I really love about this, and not to toot our own horn here, but...
toot, toot.
What I love about it, though, is... You put a lot of thought into what an inclusive concert, what a concert for children on the spectrum would look like. Mm-hmm. It's not just a movie with the lights up and the music down.
Right.
It feels like a space that was designed to make them and their parents feel comfortable, accepted maybe is the word I'm looking for.
I should also mention that in putting this together, we had an autism community advocate. And we felt that was really important to have someone who could say, you know, as an autistic person, I would prefer X or Y. And so we've had the use of a couple of very helpful advocates. And the young man who's worked with us now for a couple of programs is himself a musician. And so he's very excited about it. But they can say to us things like, well, you know, there's a lot of equipment in this room. You might want to take a minute just to explain what that is so they're not staring at it and wondering. So those sorts of things were really helpful. And as we tried to push it a little bit, say, is this going to be too much? You know, they could say, no, I think the kids are really going to respond to that. So that's been terribly helpful.
I wonder what the reaction has been from the musicians, from the music students who participate.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting thing, too, because they get some training with the Nysonger folks, because we know a lot of these music students are going to go out and they're going to be music teachers. And so at some point, they're going to be working with kids on the spectrum. And how do you do that? You know, what are the considerations? So we feel like it's a training opportunity for them as well. But one of the young volunteers came up to me at the very first session and she said, I just want you to know I'm actually autistic. And so this, you know, this is really exciting to me to see. So the response has been really good. And they get a chance to interact with the kids because they're out there while we're doing the activities. They're taking part as well.
If a parent out there has a neurotypical younger sibling, older sibling, are they allowed to come along too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's something we talked about, too. As I said, we wanted to remove any kind of barriers for this. And sometimes we've had just one parent, one kid. And other times we've sort of had the family come because, you know, it's a family outing for them. And that's been really nice. Now, they don't get the little takeaway bags and that sort of thing. But, yeah, they can come and enjoy the music and activities and things.
Final question, one more time. How do people find tickets to the Immerse event on November 16th or future Immerse events?
Absolutely. You can find it at the WOSU website. It's on our events page, so if you're there looking around, you can find it. But you can go directly there by going to wosu.org/immerse, and that's I-M-M-E-R-S-E.
That was Classical 101 Program Director Cheryl Dring. Thank you so much.
Delighted.
Coming up, how one Ohioan has made a career catering to those who stay up a little late. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
All Sides is now back, and you're still listening to Fascinating Ohio. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Our final Fascinating Ohioan today is the Outreach Coordinator for the Veterans Adventure Group, a nonprofit born of a promise to climb a mountain together after a tour of duty that's become a way to connect veterans from all walks of life through extreme sports. Stephen Paulovic is a therapist with Concord Counseling and a former Marine infantryman. Woo, I butchered that. Welcome to All Sides, Stephen.
Thank you, Anna.
You're a Marine and a longtime resident of Westerville here in Central Ohio, but you're big into mountain climbing. How did that happen? Where did you get started with it?
How did that happen? I don't think that happened in the Marine Corps. That was definitely something that happened.
You weren't stationed somewhere super mountainous.
No, I wasn't. In all the places where I was stationed, we were usually under the trees. So even if there were mountains, we couldn't see them. I did take some time off after the Marines, though, and lived in the desert of northern Mexico. So I was able to stare off at the Sierra Madre and spent a lot of time looking at them and a lot of time wondering what it would be to go there, what it would be to ascend and see what's at the top.
And eventually you started doing that. You've climbed volcanoes, peaks throughout Mexico, Central America. You've summited Mount Hood in Oregon, Mount Rainier, even Denali. That is quite an impressive list. Do you have a favorite?
I do have a favorite, Mount Rainier, which for a long time was my nemesis. It was a mountain that I spent 15 years 10 attempts trying to get to the summit solo, and was finally able to achieve it as I got older after all those attempts. I think probably halfway through, I thought, you know, I'm just going to try one more time, and couldn't get it. And next year, I'm just going to try one more time. And eventually it paid off, and I thought I was done.
You now lead groups of other veterans up different peaks. And I want to talk a little bit about what you just said, because one of the rules in mountain climbing is that going up is optional, coming down is mandatory. So how do you prepare people for that disappointment, for that possibility that they're going to do all this work, train, travel all this way, and not get to the top?
Well, we never set out to not get to the top, but we do have very frank discussions, very honest discussions about what the journey is going to be and what are those things that could end our journey, turn us around, keep us in a tent for more time than, you know, outside. So that awareness is there, that information, and the communication, which is also paramount on the mountain, that the entire team is making decisions together and evaluating things like personal fitness or whether or not the altitude is impacting somebody. And then, of course, we always watch the weather. But it's, as you said, you have to have about a half a tank of gas left when you get to the top.
Do you think your day job as a therapist and your years spent as a social worker sort of help people manage their expectations for this?
If we're talking about climbers, I do no therapy on the mountain. I may receive some on the mountain, but the two fields, yes, they're completely intertwined. I can't tell anymore where one, you know, ends and the other begins. The personal challenges of being a social worker are immense, and it's very hard for me to turn away from a challenge like the mountain when I begin working with someone who may have some very high needs or some challenges of their own that are going to be difficult. I'm often thinking of the slopes of the mountain and how that journey begins with difficult steps and a pace and keeping the eyes on the prize.
You know, you recently summited Denali with a group of veterans, and it's said to be the most strenuous of the seven summits, which I think sometimes people don't realize that it can rival Everest for its challenges and its difficulties. How did you guys fare getting up Denali?
To answer that briefly, every time we made a push on the mountain, going from the airfield to Camp 1, Camp 1 to 2, 2 to 3, each time it was the most difficult thing that each one of us had ever done in our lives. So we're talking about a 50-pound sled being dragged behind us with a 65-pound pack on.
So you didn't have Sherpas?
No Sherpas, no. That's
or the Denali equivalent of a Sherpa?
No, we did not. We had a guy named Ross that was pretty good. Ross is twice my size, so he carried a little more of some things. And each one of our climbers was very strong and offered a different skill set to that team. But Denali is absolutely a challenge. And on that particular expedition, there was a weather event that was just throwing teams off the mountain, and it was a success rate so low they hadn't seen it, I think, in my lifetime. So for us to be able to withstand, particularly around 17,000 feet where we waited out some of that weather and shot the window, we were very fortunate to put five on the summit with two injuries that had to turn around. So.
Can you tell us a little bit about Veterans Adventure Group, the group that you work for and you go with? How did you find them? How did you get in, like, how did you become a part of the organization?
It was serendipitous. I was on my very last, you know, one more mountain climb of Mount Rainier. This is the one I'm going to finally, you know, summit this thing. And it was a great climb, great window of weather, finally. And I ran into, up at Camp Muir at about 10,000 feet, ran into this large group of men and women that were so active and so excited to be on the mountain. And I met a man named Austin McCall from Veterans Adventure Group, who was cooking up something in a pot, you know, for his team. And he was impressed that I was climbing solo. I was impressed that he had this mob of veterans that he was taking to the top. And we exchanged some names and numbers. He did mention that there may be a Denali expedition coming up. So I began climbing with them, doing some Rainier climbs, Hood, and eventually Denali.
So what's it like climbing as a group with all these veterans from arguably all different parts of the country, all different walks of life?
It is fascinating because it's a slice of America, and particularly from that veteran group. We have climbers that come from the East and the South, some climbers that are already out there on the West Coast or Pacific Northwest, and they're a very interesting group. Some of the things that make them very unique are where they're coming from. We've had a female who was a West Point graduate and We have another climber who's a Harvard neuroscience student. A lot of chopper pilots, but all of them, Rangers, Marines, sailors, airmen, they are usually pretty alone in their personal lives. And probably anybody that knows a veteran could speak to the fact that they're a little different. They're a little quiet. Having them come together for another mission, another difficult mission, is very exciting because they're able to start to tap into those things from their service days, where there's a mission that they can train for, a chain of command, obstacles that have to be negotiated, and then the camaraderie, of course, of being with another brother or sister again, and you're not alone, and you don't really have to explain anything.
And it's not just mountaineering. Veterans Adventure Group also offers whitewater rafting, skydiving, all kinds of extreme sports.
They do. So we get out into the different corners of the country. And if somebody really wants to jump out of a plane, we offer it.
You don't jump out of planes, though.
I don't jump out of planes.
Do you do any of the other extreme sports or mostly mountaineering?
I've done a little bit of the rock climbing. I prefer to be up on the glacier, though. I like being up high, and I like being on a rope with my team and going after that summit.
Later this year or into early next year, you're planning to summit, I'm going to try to say this right, Aconcagua in Argentina?
Aconcagua.
Aconcagua, yes. Which is the largest mountain in the Western Hemisphere. How are you preparing for that trip?
Well, I made a run at Aconcagua last year with my team. We summited 4 of 7 climbers. I was one of the 3 that did not make it. I had to turn around about 1,000 feet short of that 22,000-foot goal because of frostbite on one side of my face. I'm preparing this year, go figure, with some more facial coverings. And now that I know the route a little better, there's some very long 20-mile hikes and 25-mile distances that we have to cover through some rough terrain even before we start going up. So I've done a lot more of that, a lot more of hiking and a lot more preparation for how to keep the right side of my body not frozen.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things that people sometimes don't understand about summiting mountains that are at higher elevations, is that sometimes there is a very long hike just to get to the part where you start the climb. Even at Everest, it's a several days hike into what's considered like the base camp, the bottom of the camp. And it can take a couple of days. It can be 20, 30 miles just to get to the place where you start the climb.
Yes. On Aconcagua, we're happy to have our friends, the mules, help out a little bit with some of those heavier loads. But there's a point where, you know, the mules are done and they drop our gear and we take it from there.
This Veterans Day is Monday, and I understand you're going to be celebrating by hiking 57 miles in 57 hours?
I am. Tonight, in just a few hours, I will, at midnight, I'll turn 57. And so I thought, well, gosh, what's a kind of mountain I can do before I get to the mountain? And calculated the math and experimented with some very long hikes and set the goal. I think I can do 57 miles in 57 hours.
Oh, my goodness. Are you doing that around here in Ohio?
I am. I'm doing that in our Westerville area.
So are you just doing loops, or what trails are you going to use?
I have done some pretty good trails all the way around the reservoir and up into Galena, which I just love. That's what I've been doing for the last 2 months, increasing my distances and seeing how the hydration goes and what the blisters do. And I'm ready now. I have some 7-mile routes that will be loops. So I think tonight, maybe I'll get 28 miles in before everybody has breakfast tomorrow, and I'll get a little nap in and then go out and try to hit another 21 and then finish it up before 9 a.m. on Sunday.
Whew, I'm tired just thinking about it.
You and me both.
I like to run. I like to run longer distances, but still 57 miles in 50s. I am not like an ultramarathon. Like, that is not me. That sounds like it's more you, but wow.
Yeah, it is my 57th birthday. So, you know, I keep reassuring myself, hey, at least I'm not turning 62 or 68.
That is fair. So this is also a fundraiser that you're doing as part of your birthday. Is that right?
It is a fundraiser. I have both a GoFundMe account set up, and our Veterans Adventure Group always has their website. And we're hoping that with Veterans Day looming, we'll have a generous public that wants to remember somebody or wants to encourage us on our expeditions, or even encourage me on maybe mile, 41 in the next couple of days here.
How do we find your GoFundMe? How do we donate if we want to?
I am new to GoFundMe. So I set up a GoFundMe, 57 miles in 57 hours for Veterans Adventure Group. We are a not-for-profit agency, so everything is tax deductible. And the folks who know me best are teasing me with $57 donations.
There you go. That sounds awesome. And the money helps different veterans go on these trips. Is that essentially what it helps to cover?
It does. We have a lot of expenses with our expeditions, but those are all paid for individually. I actually work several part-time jobs in order to be a climber. For our folks who might scuba dive, or somebody who participates in adaptive sports with Veterans Adventure Group, we don't ever want money to be the issue why they can't participate. So every penny earned, every penny raised goes right back into the equipment and the transportation needed to bring these men and women together.
That was Steve Polovic, a former Marine infantryman and works for Veterans Adventure Group. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And good luck on your 57 miles in 57 hours. And happy early birthday.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.
Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News brings the world closer. Each morning, NPR and the WOSU News team connects Columbus to the world with compelling, captivating stories.
Tuttle, their closest mall, isn't what it used to be. About 50 storefronts, including one anchor space, are open.
Listen to the difference. Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News. Global. Local.
Support is provided by Zangmeister Cancer Center, serving Columbus for over 30 years with oncology and hematology care, clinical trials, and a care coordination team for support throughout treatment, seeing newly diagnosed patients within 72 hours in Columbus, Grove City, and Westerville. ZangCenter.com.
This is WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus, 89.7 NPR News. Global. Local.
Republicans dominated the election with Donald Trump winning the presidency.
Frankly, this was, I believe, the greatest political movement of all time. There's never been anything like this in this country and maybe beyond.
And Republicans winning close races in the United States Senate.
And the Senate races in Montana, Nevada, Texas, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, were all won by the MAGA movement. They helped so much.
Now that the Senate is back under Republican control and with Trump as president-elect, we'll...
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.